Hello and welcome to episode one of Space Talks, a new half-hour program dedicated to science and all things space and produced explicitly for CKVS. I'm Stephen Lowry, the producer and co-host, along with longtime friend Tim Woods, who is standing by and residing in Brentwood Bay on Vancouver Island.
Hi there, it's great to be with you, and I'm looking forward to getting started.
Tim, as this is the inaugural program, how about outlining for our audience what the format and focal points of these Space Talk episodes will be?
Well, I'm going to be honest and admit that neither of us are rocket scientists, but I think it's fair to say that we both shared a long and deep interest in spaceflight, cosmology, and over the years, it's been a subject that I've really enjoyed in connecting with you on and with other people too. So we're hoping that we're going to find an audience of like-minded individuals who've looked up at the stars, who've read a book or two, and would like to engage again in a refreshment course, I suppose, of all the things that are happening in space, whether it's the launches of satellites, whether it's initiatives going to different planets and asteroids, or even a look back at how we got to where we are today. There's a lot to cover.
There is. And we can be sure that in every episode, we'll have errors and omissions. And we hope that when you spot them out, you drop us a line and let us know about them. Now, Tim, I know that your father and both my father had aviation military backgrounds. Do you think that your dad's background had any bearing on your interest in things in the sky or in space?
I think it did, Steve. The fact is that my father was a pilot in World War II with the RAF. He maintained an interest in aviation. Our family vacations would take us to places like the Smithsonian Institute, the great museums in Washington. We went to see the Wilbur and Wright brothers monuments in North Carolina. We sat together and watched those early launches of the Mercury program. And right through to, I think it would have been in about 1997 when my father was getting on, but we went out and out of Ottawa to try and find a nice dark place to watch the Hale-Bopp comet, which was quite visible at the time. And it was almost like a bookend for he and I in that long shared interest.
And I like the analogy of your dad having an interest, my dad having an interest. And as a matter of fact, I used to watch my dad fly overhead and fly in air shows. And I really remember in October 1957, when the Soviets launched Sputnik. Well, back then, we really didn't call them the Soviets. It was basically Russia, launched Sputnik. And at the time, we were living at the air base just south of Portage called RCF Station Southport. Our married quarters, the PMQs, were about 600 meters from the flight line. And on that cold October night, he dragged me and my brother out to the runway, looking up into the sky, seeing absolutely nothing. But that certainly piqued my interest. Looking into the void and seeing nothing. Yeah, that's my interest in space starting right there.
Well, it's remarkable that one can stare into nothing and come away with a lifelong hobby. It's really says a lot about the potential, the imagination that we humans have.
It does. And that launching of Sputnik really changed a lot of things. It changed American and therefore Western, shall we say, perspectives on their educational system, on their technological standing in the world. As we both know, coming out of World War II, America was the dominant world superpower. So what everything American was number one. And then all of a sudden you have a closed society launching a satellite ahead of your own space program. Certainly gave pause.
You know, I'm aware of the politicization of the Sputnik launch, the fallout from it. And it took place at a time when John F. Kennedy and the Democrats were very actively campaigning on a missile gap, on accusations that President Eisenhower and his Republican administration had allowed the Soviets to leap ahead of America and become a threat to the national survival. And the Sputnik launch historically just put a kind of exclamation mark on that. And it must have been a shattering moment for all involved.
As you say, Eisenhower, who was president at the time, had been the supreme Allied commander in Europe during World War II. And he was very much aware of the military and very much aware of the military-industrial complex. And he really didn't want the military to be involved into space. And as such, it was a civilian background of companies that were trying to build the first American satellite. Meanwhile, in the closed Soviet Union, in closed Russia, they were secretly going ahead full bore and creating a military ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile. And to prove its merit, it was going to launch this satellite.
Steve, I know you've followed a lot of the Cold War history, and it's been the focus of another show on this radio station. At that same time as Sputnik launched, both the Soviet Union and the United States were using whatever new technologies were available to spy from up above on their enemy, to see what their enemy was doing on the ground that might present a breakthrough technology or new threat. Sputnik must have been viewed as part of that context too, I should imagine.
Well, it's really interesting because Eisenhower was advocating what he called an open skies concept, whereby one country could overfly the other and to look down and see what was going on. And the Soviets, or again, more correctly at that time, the Russians, were absolutely against that. They didn't want the West to see how backward they were with regard to their industrial complex, the number of factories, the number of rail lines. They didn't want them to have any idea whatsoever of what they were doing. And they wanted to present, because they were trying to expand into various spheres in the eastern half of the world as well, they wanted to present this myth, this aura of communism. And so Eisenhower wanted to shatter that with an open skies concept, which the Soviets would not do. So when the Sputnik was launched, Eisenhower was actually quite pleased. He goes, well, this is amazing. The Soviets are flying over other countries. Therefore, we can do the same kind of a thing. So he was happy about that. However, the Republicans took a completely different view of it. And they looked upon it as a terrible thing, a terrible blow to American technology, and an absolute threat from above.
You know, it's an interesting parallel to make, kind of an odd one, but I think it is a good one. Remember the time in 1972 when Canada played the Russians in that hockey series, and we couldn't believe that they were capable, as they were, of playing as well or better than us at our game. And in terms of the Sputnik initiative, it was a breakthrough in the realization that somehow or other, the Russians, that sad, sad country that had been so devastated and seemed so challenged to defend itself in World War II, had somehow or another leapt this far forward. And it just left American academics and politicians and scientists in, I think, a state of confusion to some extent.
The 1972 summit series was our Sputnik.
The ability that the Russians had at the time to launch a heavy mass into space was indeed an advantage, that it was going to take a long time until the United States was able to catch up. It turns out it would be more than a decade.
The lack of having a heavy booster actually perversely was a benefit to the Americans in the long run, because they worked on miniaturizing their technology and using solid state components. So in that way, it did work. Sputnik, incidentally, was not referred to as a satellite when it first went up by Pravda. In their newspapers, they called it an artificial satellite. And they used that term artificial as an adjective over and over, because at that time, satellite was used specifically for Earth's moon and the other moons of the various planets. So the satellite is going around the Earth, and it's making this strange beep, beep sound. And at the time, it was believed that it had no scientific merit. It was simply a, here I am in space and we beat you here kind of a sound. But apparently there was some scientific merit to it. It was interesting to read that Claire Booth Luce, who was a member of Congress and wife of the publisher of Time magazine, called Sputnik a raspberry from Russia. So that was apparently from NASA, but NASA didn't exist in 1957. It 1957, it was NACA, or the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. NASA was formed 1 year later, in October 1958, as a result of Sputnik. And NASA, interesting, the A in it stands for Aeronautics and Space. So here you have a jump from just referring to a committee or organization of things in the air to things in the space as well. And interestingly, the same thing happened in Canada. The NORAD agreement, North American Air Defense Command, in the 1980s changed its name to North American Aerospace Defense Command. Meanwhile, back to the launching of the Sputnik satellite in 57, LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, who was the Democratic Speaker of the House, stated that the Soviets will, quote, be dropping bombs on us from space like kids dropping rocks onto cars from freeway overpasses. So here you have the two parts of the American government arguing with one another, one saying, hey, this is a good thing, and the other saying, this is a horrible tragedy.
I'm really struck by the fact that when Sputnik launched, it created a sense of division around the world. A threat had been created, and that is in such stark contrast to the reaction of people around the world when Apollo 11 returned to Earth. The astronauts went on a global tour, and the reaction from people around the world was, we did it, not the Americans did it, not free enterprise did it. There was a sense of a step forward for all people. And both events were remarkable in the sense of, great step forward, but they were perceived so incredibly different at the time.
Now we're going to introduce a little segment called Space Trivia, but that title might change over the time. But Tim, I think that you've got something quite of interest to you from a certain Mr. Einstein.
Mr. Einstein, indeed. Well, Einstein was probably one of the greatest minds of all time and is, of course, most famous for his scientific contributions. But he also had a sense of perspective that I think is important. And I've got a quote here, Steve. It's one that's widely attributed to Albert Einstein. It isn't sourced, and it's short. It goes like this. Logic will get you from A to B. Imagination will get you everywhere. I think that really creates a sense of hope and opens up the field of investigation and the passion for space and science, because imagination is something that each of us have. We may not have the knowledge or the expertise to be those rocket scientists, but Einstein himself understood that it takes imagination to push the pebble forward, to imagine what might be. And I just think it's a great understanding of how humans do acquire knowledge.
His adage, shall we say, is an exact parallel of how he conducted his own research. He was not a person that had large hadron colliders in front of him and things. He was a thought experimentist. He imagined about falling down an empty elevator shaft and becoming weightless and why that would happen. And he came up with time dilation as a direct correlation to speed. And yet never did any of those experiments. As a matter of fact, his gravitational lensing was proven by others doing an experiment of transitioning a Venus around the sun during an eclipse way back at the turn of the century.
And he was remarkable.
Sitting in a home saying, that's what I thought.
Well, I know he could see into the future, and I think I can too. It won't be the last time we mention Albert Einstein on this show. How about that for a prediction?
Right you are. Now, we talked in the first half of today's space talks about the very first launching of an artificial satellite, Sputnik 1. But there are so many more launches that are occurring on a daily basis. The average person have no idea how many space launches are ongoing. For instance, in the month of February coming up, there are dozens of them. And they're not solely out of Cape Canaveral. They're not solely out of someplace in Russia. What are some of these different agencies or sites that might be launching things?
There's a great many this year, and I'm going to touch on a handful, really. But I think with each one that we're going to touch on in the second half of our first episode, it's to give our audience a sense of what a wonderful, creative set, an agenda, set of launches we have to look forward to, new knowledge to be acquired. One of the first on the list is, my list is Artemis, which is the evolution of the Apollo program. It's the initiative that NASA will be taking, and it has taken, to send people back to the moon. Artemis is named after a Greek god, and although the first flight was unmanned, the next flight is scheduled for 2024, but any day now we're expecting some fairly big news that will give us lots to ponder, and that's the naming of the crews that will be the first to return to the moon. And as a Canadian, I think we're pretty excited to know that at least one of those people named will be a Canadian.
Absolutely. And to draw a parallel of how Sputnik precipitated the American involvement of heavy boosters and heavy lifting bodies, the Chinese have done a similar thing with regard to going back to the moon. They have had lunar rovers. They have stated they're planning on settling on the moon with a permanent colony. So it's not really a big wonder that Artemis is going ahead as quickly as they can at this point.
There has been activity on the moon. The Chinese, there has been activity of unmanned spacecraft going there for some time. But it is remarkable that we're nearly at the end of three generations, the traditional 20 years per generation, nearly three generations since a human set foot on the moon. It's remarkable that it's taken this long. And as you say, without that, the impetus of the Cold War, politics has really made it impossible to generate the enthusiasm to spend the money necessary. So that's Artemis. We can look forward to the naming of those astronauts very soon. Okay. I also wanted to mention the Artemis named after a Greek god. The next one on my list is far less romantic, known as CLPS, or Commercial Lunar Payload Services. My goodness, you couldn't get further away from pulling at your heartstrings. Commercial Lunar Payload Services.
It sounds like a private firm.
It does indeed. And in many ways it is. There's partnerships, over a dozen, that have been created between NASA and private sector companies. Four launches are planned for this coming year to the moon, each designed to generate an exploration of the moon and look for resources. Now, as you mentioned, the Chinese are already vastly underway in that regard, and CLPS is an American NASA initiative to partner with private sector firms, and I think it's fair to say they see gold in them their hills on the lunar surface.
I almost can smell a lawsuit coming on, because the United States, the Soviet Union at the time, and a number of other companies or countries signed an agreement that nothing could be claimed outside of the Earth's atmosphere as belonging to a particular country. China did not sign that. So the speculation is rampant now that when China lands, they are going to claim the moon as their own when they set up a permanent base. And therefore, others landing and trying to mine whatever resources are there, including water. We know there's water on the moon, subsurface and in a frozen state. So this will be an interesting thing.
If we end up having a fight for the ownership of the lunar landscape, our next mission, maybe by the time we get to Jupiter, we'll have a chance to sort out this and make it so that there isn't an ownership battle. Jupiter's got people interested again. What's going on there?
I love how the aerospace industry likes its acronyms. And in April, they're scheduled to launch the JUICE missions. Now, JUICE stands for Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer. So they are going to be sending out missions to Ganymede, Callisto, and Europa. Frozen moons, almost planets, because they're big enough in some aspects. And these potentially have oceans in which things might have come to life. There might be life forms in those oceans. So anyway, JUICE is going to Jupiter. I wonder if they'll find the black monolith that that Bowman was looking for. But anyway,
I'm gonna say no to that. It is remarkable where they're going. I mean, Jupiter is five times further away from the sun than we are, and yet they're expecting to find oceans under the surfaces of those three moons, which they are inclined to believe, or at least theorize, as to being habitable. And there is science planned to see if there is evidence of life that has ever been under those I wouldn't say they're waves, under that frost.
Well, you mentioned Jupiter being so large. You know, that let's just say that you could parachute down to Jupiter. You're in one of these juice missions. You say, let's just take a little excursion to Jupiter. I'm just going to take a little sideline here and parachute down. You could never land on the surface of Jupiter, discounting the winds, because the surface, it's a gas giant. And so there is no rocky surface as there is on the Earth. And the gravitational is so strong that you would eventually reach a layer of liquid hydrogen, metallic liquid hydrogen. It is such a bizarre place that I don't think anyone will be going to Jupiter itself at any given time. Now, another one coming up, Tim, is the Boeing Starliner CST, and CST stands for Crew Space Transportation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so far, the Boeing folks have had their Starliner make one flight to the ISS without a crew on board back in 2022. The hope is that this year, in April, in fact, they'll launch a manned craft, the Starliner, and it looks a whole lot like the Apollo spacecraft. It's a little bit bigger than the Apollo spacecraft, carries up to 7 crew, and it's essentially designed for just that commuting of people and goods to the ISS and other low Earth orbit missions. The expectation is, if all goes well, future missions to the ISS for the time it has remaining will be managed by trips made by SpaceX and Boeing and its Starliner. So it's been quite a long time in gestation, but we're just around the corner from that new entrant into the servicing of the ISS.
And as you mentioned, the ISS does have a shelf life. First of all, perhaps our viewers don't know, it's constantly degrading in its orbit. So every now and then it has to be boosted into a higher orbit. And things wear out on it. It's been up there for a long time. It's already passed its first planned deorbit, and it's working on borrowed time. Do you happen to recall when its final phase is expected to be?
I think 2030 is the last year the last date I recall seeing. It's really not that far away. I think we're under a decade to go now.
There is another very interesting space flight, which has already happened. This particular one took off in September the 8th, 2016. It's called OSIRIS-REx. This is another one of our mythological satellites. OSIRIS standing for Origins. See, this is another wonderful thing about the aerospace industry. They'll come up with an acronym that they like as fancy, and then they'll work around words that fit it. So for OSIRIS, it stands for Origins Spectral Interpretation Resource Identification Security Regolith Explorer. No one's ever going to remember that, but they will remember OSIRIS. Now, who was OSIRIS in mythology?
I'm going to give you 5 points if you can answer your own question.
Well, I think it's the mythological Egyptian god of the underworld. So OSIRIS went out and landed on an asteroid called Bennu, B-E-N-N-U, in 2018, and it's coming back to Earth scheduled this September, September 24th, 2023. The spacecraft itself is not going to come back, but its payload is a monstrous payload of 60 grams.
And they just roll down the window and toss it out?
Well, you know, the early satellites, reconnaissance satellites, did a similar thing. They threw a bucket out of the satellite when it was parachuted down to Earth and captured in by a hook on the rear end of an airplane. But that's another story.
So it is exciting to think that this will be the first delivery of this kind. Talk about takeout.
Well, Tim, it looks like we're out of time for this inaugural episode of Space Talks, and we invite you to tune in next week when our topic will be asteroids, meteor impacts, and their effect upon not only the planet, but us humans as well. So until then, this is Stephen Lowry and Tim Wood saying so long, and we'll see you next time on Space Talks.